Never played with a player like that on this team.
Hello, Bulls fans. Welcome to another off-season edition of the Chicago Bullseye. I am your host, Mark Lewenthal. With me, as always, is the main man, Fred Pfeiffer. And today, we have a special guest with us. We've had a lot of special guests recently, but we have a new special guest with us today. We have Chris Terzic from Bloggable joining us. Chris, thanks for joining the show, man. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Looking forward to the conversation and talking a little Bulls in the dead of summer. It's much needed.
It absolutely is, and I feel like, you know, a lot of people think that there's absolutely nothing going on right now, but I feel like there's still a lot of things to discuss, even though it's the summertime. This, to me, was what I was always kind of waiting for, in the sense that I felt like when Derek was coming back that you couldn't expect the world from him that first year, and that it's like he's got that year under his belt. It's kind of like Jordan's second year after his second comeback. I feel like this has always been the year in my book that I thought that we could challenge for a championship. So, I mean, I know a lot of people have different varying opinions. A lot of people think last year was our year, but at least from my perspective, I certainly think this is a very important offseason and that there's a lot to discuss in terms of what our potential is moving forward. So I appreciate you coming on. And Fred, how you doing?
Living the dream, Mark. Living the dream. I'm really excited to have Chris on. I've been a big fan of his work over at Bloggable. And I'm really excited to hear talk about this Gasol article. I know we'll get a little bit into Chris's history with Gasol. He's kind of like the St. Paul of Bulls beat writers, I think, where he's kind of come around on Gasol, which is good. I know Bloggable's put on a lot of hit jobs on Gasol. But there's one thing I know we definitely are in agreement, Chris, and that's our mutual dislike for the game of Kirk Heinrich. Is that correct?
That is absolutely 100% correct. I fear for what's coming this season. I don't know about you, Fred, but for both you guys, I don't know what your feelings are, but I think we're going to see a lot more of Captain Kirk than I think any of us would like to see, unfortunately.
I personally think he's the
19th man on the roster with a new coach, and I think only Tom Thibodeau is dumb enough to be playing it. Look, everyone saw it last year. Everyone saw it. We have depth at that position. I would be shocked if Fred Hoiberg is not open-minded in terms of how he approaches the team. I think he wants to win it. Thibodeau was set to shoot. I don't expect to see a lot of Kirk Heinrich, but I don't. Maybe you guys differ.
Oh my gosh! And I would kind of concur with Mark. If he's going to be playing Heinrich like Tibbs used to, especially I go back to that month of January where I think Heinrich probably shot. I don't know. It seemed like he could have punted the ball and had a better percentage. And we had to endure this night after night. Snell's on the bench. You know, it was just disgusting. And, you know, basically I think it took an injury to Heinrich for him basically to get out of there, if I recall. But anyhow, if Fred can't see this, then we're in big trouble. I think my hope is that he's going to play him, you know, 10 minutes. I'm fine with him playing as a backup to Rose at the point guard position.
Ew.
I never want to see that idiot again playing the shooting guard position, trying to stretch the floor, because nobody pays attention to him. He sucks.
Right.
He can't shoot.
Yeah, he's useless out there.
Yeah, so I mean, I wish we all came to agreement on this. It seems like, you know, I was a voice in the wilderness 3 years ago, you know, when he was shooting under 40%. Now it seems like there's a lot of people in agreement with me, but there's still a couple of these, you know, 100-level people from Barrington out there that still love him. So, you know, one of these days they'll wake up and realize this guy's done. So I hope Fred makes that transition to, you know, for Kirk to, you know, assistant coach, mascot, whatever he wants him to do. I don't care, just as long as he's not on the court.
Don't you guys think, though, to some degree that, I mean, Thibodeau had non-conventional ways of thinking about almost everything, in my opinion, such as the fact that, you know, Gasol, Butler, all these guys were almost leading the leagues in minutes, especially Gasol, that, you know, so many things. The fact that when Rose came back when he tore his ACL, the fact that he missed so many games that year and so many minutes, and then he's coming back playing 38 minutes a night, it seemed like Tibbs was very non-conventional and his approach to the game in general. So I don't feel like this is going to be a traditional year from what we are used to over the last 3 or 4 years. I don't think that that's the norm. I really think that Tibbs was a non-conventional coach. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think, well, in relation to Heinrich and kind of Tibbs's, if you want to call it an unconventional, unreasonable love for Kirk Heinrich, the organization gave him that player option for the season. And in their minds, I think when they gave him this, you know, the contract to bring him back stupidly again, they envisioned him being a part of this team. And kind of like Fred said, I'm hoping 10 minutes a game, you know, just the backup role, very limited action, that would be ideal to me. But the front office, I think, still views him as a piece to the team, which is scary to me, which definitely, you know, it doesn't make me feel good. They're a little bit uneasy going into the season that we're yet again one injury away from forcing Kirk Heinrich into minutes that he cannot – he's not capable of playing anymore. So that's definitely a concern, and I'm a bit uneasy on that front, just how they decided that they're going to bring back the same roster. The front office believes that Tibbs was the problem, not a part of it, and I think that Tibbs was a part of the problem, but he wasn't the entire thing, kind of like the front office Garn and Paxton, they think he was. So that kind of scares me, just going into things, and that's you know, I do hope that Kirk is more of a mascot role than he is the 20-minute-a-night guy, but, you know, we'll see. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Let me
just get a follow-up in here to that, because this is the one point I kind of disagree on in general, that the front office is in love with Kirk. If we go back in time, they absolutely traded him. Not only did they trade him, they had a – throw away an asset to get rid of his fat contract in 2010, that summer, right? They gave away a number one pick just to get his rear end out of town. And flash forward, I think it was a year or two later, I still even remember reading in the paper this interview with Reinsdorf, and Reinsdorf said the question was something to the effect of, what do you regret, you know, about the Bulls and that season? And this guy has the nerve to say, I regret it. The trade of sending Kirk, and I literally almost vomited all over the paper. So to me, that's where the issue is. I think there was a lot of discussion. Yeah, you know, Reinsdorf putting it in the ear of Garpax. Why don't we bring him back? You know, because believe it or not, he is beloved. Probably to me, outside of maybe Jordan and Pippen, one of the most beloved Bulls of all time. I mean, I can't even believe how much support this guy gets for such the average player that he is. For whatever reason. So I kind of view it as, you know, more of a, you know, I don't think the front office is like, we got to have this guy. It's not like it's a huge contract. You know what I mean? It's not like taking a massive amount of money. But, you know, so I don't have as much of an issue with the front office. I think it's more coming down from the chairman. You saw that when he brought back Harold Baines of the White Sox as a coach. I mean, the guy's basically a deaf mute, and they bring him the coach. I mean, what does that mean? I kind of view the same thing with Heinrich. I'm not saying that the front office doesn't like him. They do, I'm sure. They probably view him as, you know, having those leadership qualities. But I don't blame the front office as much. I just blame Kirk. I mean, how hard is it to just hit jump shots when you're wide open? Get in the stinking gym. It's been like this for 3 straight years. And he's always been like this. I mean, he's had multiple years as a player where he shot under 40%. That's inexcusable. You know, and guys just want to keep on defending him like he's a capable player. The guy sucks. He was a disgrace last year. And, you know, so we're going to keep on defending him and act like this is still, you know, 2006 when he was, you know, legitimately good. Guy sucks. He should be playing 5-10 minutes, and that's the end of it. And after this contract runs out, let him go off and get his little statue.
Yeah,
Chris, let me ask you this.
With Jerry. Yeah, go ahead.
You were throwing out there the fact that the team is bringing back the same team as last year, that it concerns you. In my opinion, at least as far as the Kirk Heinrich decision was concerned, you know, Kirk in 2010-11 had a good year in relative to the rest of his career. He had a bit of a down year in Atlanta.
He wasn't on the team.
He didn't play as much. But I'm just
Washington,
saying,
Mark.
But what I'm saying is that – you're right. But what I'm saying is that when they re-signed him, I don't think the fact that you gave him – well, I guess you gave him – the player option was last year. So this is the option year. He re-signed in 13-14 with an option for the following year. I don't think that that's the most ridiculous – like, he had an option, so that's why he's coming back. Besides Kirk Heinrich, are you upset with anybody coming back this year?
there's value in continuity and having a team that has rapport with each other, that's comfortable playing with one another. There's certainly value in that. And I don't know if the way the season ended last year just left a sour taste in my mouth, and I was just kind of disgusted with what I saw and how they were unable to accomplish what I thought they could beat a LeBron. They could beat LeBron. Really, that's what it came down to. I thought that those guys in that team could beat LeBron by himself, because that's what it was. I mean, it was just bare bones. It was LeBron and his sidekicks. So, you know, not the conventional sidekicks, not the good players. Obviously, Love and Irving were out, but it's like it was just James Jones was running out there, and Mike Miller was running out there. They couldn't beat that team. But anyway, to you know, answer your question, there is value in bringing guys that are familiar with one another back together. I certainly hear that argument, and there's you know, a solid claim to that. But I'm concerned with the backup point guard position beyond Kirk. I think Aaron Brooks showed us last year in the playoffs that he's a liability if he can't score. He's always a liability on defense just due to his size. He's just a small backup point guard, and he can get bullied, and he can get eaten up by screens, and he's just susceptible to some things defensively that are not much of his fault. He's just a small guy. He's just a tiny dude. I'm a little bit concerned with what Fred's going to do with the front court, which is still undetermined, and you know, we've yet to see what Fred has indicated one way or another what he's going to do with the front court. But there needs to be more balance there. There needs to be more balance in the way that front court is divided. You know, I think that there should be at least somewhat. We need to get more Nico first and foremost, which is just my general stance on the front court. I think he's the best front court player we have. And then with the wings are fine. Obviously bringing Jimmy back was as important as anything, and they did that, and they locked him up long-term. That was great. You know, the Bulls, they were a little bit handcuffed this offseason. They were limited in their ability to make moves, and they didn't have a lot of flexibility. That was just kind of the reality of the situation. We all know that the Bulls don't like to make trades unless there's the salary dump involved. I mean, they're just not the organization that goes out and makes a trade player for player, you know, talent acquisition type thing. They're looking to either dump off a contract, or they're looking to open up some space, or they're always looking for kind of ways to open up some assets rather than going out and getting a player, an upgrade. That's just not been in their MO in the front office for as long as Paxson and Foreman have been there together. But, you know, I guess this team is still, they're still a 50-win team. They can still be a 50-win team. That's good enough in the East. So, you know, I think that's the important thing to remember above all else.
Don't you think, though, they were pretty, you know, pretty close to also, you know, being a 60-win team? I mean, look how many games they lost to crappy teams, you know, to bad teams at home. You know, for whatever reason, they didn't seem to have that extra gear. Noah was rarely healthy. Noah missed a considerable amount of games. I think he missed, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15 games. Taj missed between 10 and 15 games. It wasn't like they were injury-free. Rose missed 6 weeks. You know, there were quite a bit of injuries with the exception of Gasol. You know, they won 50 games. Still, if you look at it, I didn't really think they played, you know, up to their capabilities. They still had some great wins, winning the Golden State. So, yeah, they were a 51 team. That's what they are. But wouldn't you agree that, you know, potential-wise, that team could have won more games last year? And then looking at the team this year, if you get Nico to make another step, you get McDermott to actually participate, and you get just the other guys who put in, you know, regular years, isn't this team potentially a 60-win team?
60 seems like a bit of an overestimation in my opinion. I think you definitely have a good point in that the team last year, they lost so many games to scrubs, just to bottom feeder teams. There was a stretch there in January where they're blown out by Utah and by the Magic. They lost like a 120-point game or a shootout. Like, they lost so many games last season where it was just beyond frustrating to watch. Like, how can they go from winning in Golden State, being one of two teams all last year to win in Oracle Arena, to losing to the Boston Celtics and the Brooklyn Nets? And, you know, getting blown out by the Brooklyn Nets. Like, it just didn't make sense. You know, that
right.
was so confusing. They were very bipolar. So, yeah, 60 seems like a lot. A 50-win team, for sure, that's absolutely within reason. That should be the mark that their expectation should be 50 wins, I think, for sure.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Fred personally. I personally feel that they grossly underachieved, especially because they went through a few stretches where they lost a ton of games, and also the fact that they lost to so many crappy teams. But I don't. At the end of the day, I mean, the talent on this team, I really feel like at the end of the day, the focus, whenever you've got some loose cannon in the mix, it's something that, you know, harms the overall team. And when it's the coach, it's just, I've never seen such a gross, just ridiculousness by a coach in terms of being a distraction. I've never seen a coach be such a freaking distraction that I saw Thibodeau be this year.
Yeah.
And I just feel like at the end of the day, that's one of the most important positions that there is. And I felt by the end of his tenure here that he really wasn't that good of a coach, and that he had his points periods where he was. But I don't feel like this season Thibodeau was that great of a coach. And if this team was well coached, I mean, they're the only team that beat Golden State in Golden State. Now, that's only one game. But at the same time, it's like they had some very big quality wins. They had a lot of really bad losses to bad teams. I just found there to be inconsistency, and I feel like I don't know if Hoiberg – I don't like to judge coaches that I've never seen that haven't had NBA talent or NBA experience before, and I'm okay with the fact that he hasn't, because generally if you're getting, who you're going to go get? You're going to go get the guy that they just got the guy that's coaching the New Orleans Pelicans or – whatever, these random
Gentry.
Coaches have been fired a thousand times. Guys have been fired a thousand times. Are you going to get one of those, or are you going to take a risk and get somebody that could end up being the next Brad Stevens? I think that's what the Bulls are going for. Whether Hoiberg ends up being that or not is to be seen. But I really feel like if this team has the right system, this team could beat. I don't feel like the Bulls got beaten by the Cleveland Cavaliers. I feel like the Bulls beat themselves. They could have won that series.
No, that's such a tough call, Mark. I really do. I mean, we just say that so easily, but the fact is LeBron won the series, right? I mean, even in the games where he did not play well, he's still attracting so much attention, leaving other guys with open opportunities. And then Gasol got hurt, and I know everybody wanted to minimize Gasol's contribution last year. And, we'll get into that right now, and we'll come back to this, because that was the main reason I wanted to have Chris on, because Chris, I guess let's start out by talking about a little bit about your overall evolution on Gasol. You were a hater, and then you came around, and now you're one of, I wouldn't call you a rabid supporter, but you do clearly realize, based on your last article, and I encourage everybody to go check it out. I'll make sure I post it up at the Chicago Bullseye. I thought you did a very even-handed job of describing, Paul Gasol's benefits and his detractions. At one end, I'm the biggest pro Gasol guy there is, and then on the other end, you got that couch change, whatever his name is, over at the Bloggable, who just did a hatchet job on him earlier. So, give us a little bit about what your stance is on Gasol.
Yeah, well, with Powell, like you said, with you're alluding to with the Cleveland series, that was the eye opening, the kind of illuminating moment for me personally. Because prior to that series and before Powell was out for, what was it, games 4 and 5 he was out for? Yeah, he came back for 6. When he was out those games, it just, his importance to the offense was just imperative. Everything was kind of centered around, no pun intended, or what he did and what he brought to the offense. His jumper, which I think I saw that all along. I saw the points being scored. Maybe I dismiss them a little too much. There's just so much. He's one of the few guys. Powell's one of the few guys in the game today that can take that 16-foot, 17-foot jumper, and that's a good shot for him. I mean, we've seen across the board in the NBA, that's a shot that is dying. That's a shot that has been – there's a conceded effort to eliminate that shot, but that's a great shot for Powell just because how efficient he is, how often he makes that. In that article, I think I threw the – his catch-and-shoot statistics, which are it's around 50%, and that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
To be catch-and-shoot and shoot around 50%, that just doesn't happen, especially for a 7-footer, nonetheless.
Let me just jump in and make a point really quick on this, because this is a really good point that I think a lot of people miss. I hear a lot of people arguing about how great Jimmy Butler was this year. No doubt, Jimmy worked hard, made a ton of improvements, but I think people minimize the fact that having Paul Gasol on the court, what that did for Jimmy Butler. What's Jimmy Butler's best asset? It's to get to the rim and draw fouls. Having a big man away from the basket And a second or two late, as Jimmy gets to the lane, means he's going to get fouled more often. It's going to give him that lane. It's going to give him opportunities to score. Nobody, you never heard anyone say, hey, you know, hey, Jimmy's part of the reason he had such a fantastic year. Could have been potentially, I don't know, with the addition of a guy in four or five that could actually bring out and open up space for him to drive. So I really do think that his ability to hit that 17, 18-footer, not only that, he shot 50% from the corner three this year. I think he's extended his range, and I want to see him, you know, hopefully get more opportunities or attempts this season. So sorry to interrupt you, but it is a good point that you made that isn't, I don't think, brought up enough.
That's true. With Jimmy's progression last year, with having less action around the paint, there was certain – Powell still had his share of post-ups, and that's just a staple of a Tom Thibodeau offense. He's just – he believes that a post-up, the value in the post-up is still there, and, you know, we can quabble over that, whether it is or it isn't, you know, where the game's moving more towards the three-point line, that's whatever. I think you still need a post-presence. You know, I don't think you can just ignore it completely, and that's why a guy like Powell brings value to a team, because – when he was out in that Cleveland series, there were stretches where the team went 7-8 minutes without scoring, and those are the moments why you signed Pau Gasol, because you need to throw the ball in the post. You know, that's when you need that guy that you can throw it to and just get those points. And he didn't have him then, and that's when it became clear that Pau was super important to this ball club. And with what I wrote last week, I didn't try to speculate too much on how Hoiberg was just planning on using power, what's going to happen, because I'm just unsure. You know, we kind of talked about Tibbs and Hoiberg already. I don't know what Fred Hoiberg is yet. We have yet to see game action. I'm not going to base anything off of Summer League. I'm certainly not going to go there. You know, I watched it, but I don't think we can conclude anything definitively. There's no evidence. You know what I'm saying? Like, we can't say, Fred did this in Summer League, so now we can assume he's going to do – like, I just don't think that's at all accurate. But one thing I wouldn't rule out, and one thing I hope Fred does – utilizing Powell is kind of like a stretch five type guy. I'm not saying he has to shoot, you know, above the break three pointers or anything like that, but use him in that corner. Like you said, he shot 50% from the three pointers last season. That's an asset. It's valuable there. You know, if you can exploit that, if you can figure out a way to turn that into more frequent points or put Powell in situations where he can get those shots, that'd be great for the offense. And it's expanding the floor. It's allowing more room for drives. And those are all things that Derek and Jimmy specifically need desperately. They need room to drive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely agree. And that's where a lot of my frustration was with Thibodeau this year, is and how he utilized Gasol. So if we just got a new guy, Mark, I didn't mention this to you, but we got a kind of like an analytics guy that's just a brilliant kid who's I've asked him for a couple stats, and one of the stats he gave me was last year the Bulls, Taja Noah, surprisingly, had almost the exact same amount of shots outside the paint. Approximately 2 out of every 10 shots they took were outside of the paint. So 8 out of 10, they're shooting inside the paint. Noah had, believe it or not, under 50% in the restricted area, which is a horrible percentage. But if you go back in time, you know, a lot of it is tips, and a lot of missed layups and whatever. So anyhow, Gasol, though, twice that. He had twice as many attempts outside the paint, you know, which goes in line with how Tibbs used him. I thought he used him more as a stretch, kind of a stretch five, and every once in a while he'd throw him in the post every 4 possessions or so. So I think my point was basically that, you know, that's my frustrations were with Tibbs. When he was not in, I don't think he was in the post enough. If you look at the Milwaukee series, they were doubling him every time he touched the ball in the post, and yet he's still playing him on the perimeter. When you know a team is going to throw a double team at a guy, you know what's going to happen, and you could dictate where it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And you still – and for the first 4 games of the series, what are you doing? You have Rose at the top of the key, basically, or on that side, on the Gasol side in the post, as your man standing at the three-point line. Why are you doing that? You know, Rose is not going to hurt you there. You got to have somebody that can actually hit that three, you know, basically, on that same side. It was beyond frustrating. I never thought Tibbs did enough advantage. And I think Hoiberg will.
I agree, especially in the Milwaukee series. Yeah, no, that Milwaukee – Tibbs never devised a way to beat that double team. When Milwaukee was showing their hand from the opening minute of that series, they said they told us exactly what they were going to do when Powell touched the ball on the post, and he never devised a way to figure out how to counteract that. And that was what's so frustrating with Tibbs. It's like, dude, we're watching the same thing for 6 games straight, and you have not changed a bit, the game plan. You have not changed an iota. It's like, that's crazy.
In fairness to Tibbs, in game six, I did notice what they were trying to do then is getting – they were trying to swing around to the opposite side to get an open three, which did work quite a bit well. But
it did, yeah.
In my opinion, after five games, that's what you come – you can't do that. That should be done in game – the second half of game one, not game six.
Yeah.
You know, and I honestly think it was probably one of his buddies, Keenan McCall, you know, somebody he actually listens to, like maybe Jeff Van Gundy, and say, hey, why don't you try this? You know, honestly, because the guy just – he shows no flexibility. I do want to get into – so did you want to add anything about just your general viewpoint of Paul? Or, because there is something specific I want to ask you about before – I didn't want to interrupt you on that.
With in regards to Paul?
No, let me get into just the question I had regarding – his defense. So why don't you give us a little bit of your opinion on defensively, his strengths and weaknesses.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. His defense, that was during the regular season one of the things where I was a major critic of what he does on defense, or rather what he doesn't do. And one of the points that I tried to make when I wrote about Powell was there's a difference between a shot blocker and a rim protector. Like those two terms, they're kind of thrown together, and they're not as interchangeable as I think the common fan or, you know, the avid NBA follower, whatever. There needs to be a distinction between those two terms. And Powell is a shot blocker. You know, make no mistake about it. He was top 10 in blocks last year. He blocked way more shots than I think any of us could have reasonably expected. Even for him, I think it was third most in his career. It was towards the top of his career in terms of total number of blocks. He brought value to that. But teams kept attacking him, and he also faced the most shots at the rim last season per game on average. So which tells me, and what that says is, teams were willingly and relentlessly putting him in situations where they wanted to go at the basket and they wanted to drive on him. Or they wanted to get a situation where a ball handler was in a mismatch with Powell and they could kind of drive right by him. That's what that number would imply, which tells me that he's not a rim protector then, because teams are actively seeking him out. If he were a rim protector, teams would try and keep him away from the paint. They wouldn't try and keep – and I know that where he's stationed in Tibbs' defense, or where he was stationed, you know, past tense, in Tibbs' defense, the center's role was to kind of be that funnel between the man setting a screen in the pick and roll and the ball handler, and where the defensive guard would be. Powell was supposed to be stationed kind of in between. He's not supposed to extend too far, but, you know, he still needs to kind of get a hand up and contest on a shot, which is what Joe Kimno was so great at. Joe was great at forcing a guy to take that, like, 12-foot in-between floater shot and then turning around and grabbing the rebound. That's Joe's specialty. That's what he, you know, made his Defensive Player of the Year reputation on. But Powell is long. He plays really long. He plays with his arms up, and that is a skill. You know, think back to, like, Eddie Curry. Eddie Curry is huge. He's massive, but he played like he was 6'6" on defense, I should say. On offense, I mean, he was great at, you know, putting his rear end into a guy and using that baby right-handed hook. He was phenomenal at that. But, you know, defensively, yeah, Powell does play long. It's just that he's so slow. He's 35, so, I mean, that was just to be expected. You know, I didn't think that Powell was going to come to Chicago last year and all of a sudden transform into some super quick mobile big. That just would have been unreasonable. But it is the fact that he has no lateral movement whatsoever just makes him very susceptible to guards driving right past him. Lack of quickness is just a major problem to me. Yeah, go ahead.
So this is the one point that I didn't necessarily disagree, but I had a little bit I had a definite disagreement in the thesis, which your thesis is that the game plan for the other teams when they were playing Bulls was, let's take it right to Gasol. In general, that's what the point was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's get him in that situation. So, number one, the Bulls last year were one of the best teams at guarding the three-point line, and I think the game has evolved into that almost to the point now where I think in your article, correct me if I'm wrong, you said something to the effect that the goal is to get it, you know, at the basket, which
right.
I do disagree with a little bit. And it's not necessarily. I mean, there's teams like Atlanta now where I actually think, you know, their goal is just as much as layup is get an open three, right? So there's a lot of attacking at the three-point line. And the Bulls were consciously not going to let that happen. You know, in a Thibodeau defense, we're not going to give open threes. We're going to contest every outside jumper, no matter who's shooting. That's just you know, one of Thibodeau's main tenets. The team on the perimeter, and so first of all, correct me if I'm wrong, did the stat, you had a stat in there that said basically that Gasol was the sixth best rim defender, correct? Is that right? Can we go back to that for 1 second? He was sixth in the league at defensive at the rim. I don't know where he got that stat.
He was seventh in total shots blocked. I don't know about at the rim. For that piece, I used Nylon Calculus. Seth Partnow, he's a great writer.
There you go.
He developed his own rim protection stat. It's not super intricate or anything like that. But basically, I think it was looking at points saved per 36 minutes, I think was the stat I threw in there, which is just like to even out the playing field for guys that face a disproportionate amount of shots. He wasn't horrible. He wasn't as bad as I thought at protecting the rim, which I think is another thing that I changed my viewpoint on Powell from the beginning of the season. He wasn't as bad as I felt or I thought he was. Maybe my eyes were telling me he was. You know, when the numbers kind of bear it out, he was just brutal. You know, he wasn't good, but he was somewhere average.
In the middle.
Low average.
And that's how I feel he is too. So I think it just the Bulls suffer. It's suffering by comparison. When you have Noah and Gibson on the same team, who are probably two of the top five elite front court defenders in the league. At least Noah was the year before. Probably not last year, but, you know, Gibson absolutely, when he's healthy, is as good as it gets. And then you got a guy like Gasol out there. People are like, this guy sucks. Not really. He's just like pretty much everybody else, whereas Noah and Taj are special. But the back to the original point I wanted to make was my problem was with the way Tibbs used Gasol. Go back to how on defense. Let's go back to how Jackson had Bynum and Gasol on those title Laker teams. Two centers playing with each other. Go back and watch those tapes. The Lakers, you rarely ever saw Bynum or Gasol leave the paint. Whereas in Thibodeau's defense, you know, it looks really good when you got Kevin Garnett and you got Noah. And you got Taj, but when you have a normal center, not going to look as nice when you're guarding guys out 30 feet on a pick and roll. I mean, I wanted to put my head through a window against Orlando. You got Alfred Payton. They're setting picks 30 feet out, and I think that was you know, one of the games that you brought up. Why are you sending Gasol 30 feet out of the paint, you know, 10 feet out of the paint, 30 feet out from the basket to hedge on, you know, to basically stop the pick and roll with Alfred Payton?
Yeah.
And even those clips that you showed in the article, if you notice, every one of those clips, it was against the Sixers, Gasol was outside the paint. Gasol should have never left the paint last year. That should be the number one
point. And there's definitely an argument to be made, and I've kind of played around with this argument in my head a little bit. I'm not sure where I fall on it, but the fact that Tibbs had Kevin Garnett and a prime Joakim Noah and a prime Taj Gibson and Luol Deng, and even, you know, Keith Bogan, these are all great, great defenders that we're talking about. So it's like, the system is one thing, but maybe the system was as good as it was because the players were unbelievable defenders. You know, and that's a great argument. I certainly, you know, I thought about it a little bit. It's like, you know, I don't know. Is Tibbs the smart
player? Well, especially
the players, too.
You know, when you really start noticing it is when you think about, when was Garnett hurt? What happened there? Well, you had Ben Gordon throwing 42 points on him in the Boston Garden. You had just point after point happening from guys. So my point about Tibbs the whole time is he's been blessed with three. Kevin Garnett arguably is the best interior defender in history, you know, let alone.
Yeah, yeah.
You can make that argument. It's definitely one of the most versatile and quickest big men. And then you have Noah Gibson from day one. Your defense is going to be good. Unless you are some kind of incompetent fool, it's going to be good. And when he didn't have Garnett healthy, the Bulls, you know, took advantage of that. So, you know, just my point is here, Tibbs refused to change his system. He has, again, this is a situation where you're trying to make the talent adapt to the system instead of having the system adapt to the talent. And he's expecting Gasol to do things that he just can't do. I'm hoping Hoiberg this year says, hey, Pa, I don't want you leaving the paint. And if we play a stretch five that's going to make you leave the paint, then I'll just take you out. You know, you're not going to be in the game. You know, and the good news is there's not a lot of stretch fives, you know, that are going to hit jumpers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, knocking on wood will be okay there. So that was the only kind of disagreement I had a little bit where I think the point you were making is that there were a ton of attacks at Gasol at the rim. I think it's kind of by design in the Thibodeau offense, and also because he didn't really utilize Gasol, you know, in the best way I thought that he saw fit. You know, expecting him to do pick and roll defense, you know, so far away from the basket is just going to expose him and make him look bad.
Yeah, no, that's
Mark,
a good point. Mark,
sweet, are you there?
Yeah, no, I'm listening to you guys. Continue.
Yeah, sorry. All right, Chris, go on, man. This is good stuff, though. It's good stuff.
No, that's a really good one. And something that I hadn't considered too much, just the way that Tibbs employed Gasol last year on the defensive end. You know, you're asking a 34-year-old with countless number of minutes and miles on those legs and that body to go out and defend above the free throw line extended on pick and rolls at the top of the key, or, you know, from on the baseline sideline pick and rolls and those ice situations. You know, it's like you're asking a guy that's just, his skill set does not fit what you're requiring of him. That's just, you know, you're trying to plug in circled holes into square pegs. You know, it's like that just doesn't add up. You're putting a guy in a position to fail almost on the defensive end. You know, it's like certainly you expect him to be able to thwart the defense, the offensive players a little bit, but yeah, it's just you're setting up Powell to struggle, and that's what we saw.
Yeah, look bad. Yeah, look bad. And every made makes he's terrible offensively. You know what's the problem? And I just want to say, everybody step back. We fell from second when Noah was at his MVP-ish. And an NBA Defensive Player of the Year self, we were second in the league in defense. We were 28th in offense efficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gasol joins the team. We lose DJ. We get Rose, but he's out for 6 weeks. What happens?
But Butler completely changes. But go on.
We fall from 2 to 9, I think, defensively, and we go from 28 to 11. Butler completely changes. You know, he definitely was better offensively, Mark. I'm not denying that. I think there's probably a little bit to do with it. But you don't go from 28 to 11 just by Jimmy Butler getting, you know, an extra 7 points a game. What did he average here before, 13? I mean, I think a ton they had to do. Yeah, but he missed 6 weeks. And then D.J. Augustine was fantastic. Look at D.J. Augustine's numbers here before.
D.J. Augustine was not nearly as good as Derrick Rose.
What about Noah's fall off offensively compared to the year before? I mean, that's a historic spot.
You still got like a 30-point increase between Derrick Rose and Jimmy Butler.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't anywhere near.
What did Butler average the year before? 10 points a game? What did he average? Was it 13?
I would say 13 off the top of my head. You got a computer in front of you?
Can you
look that up? I think he went from 13 to 20, and I think the difference between DJ was probably about 15. The Rose, where was Rose this year? DJ was 14. 14
just under
9,
18, maybe?
Yeah.
This year, Rose averaged 17.
17, yeah.
I'm not saying
Butler
that
Butler averaged 13 last year. He was 20 this year, but he averaged 39% last year. He was 46% this year.
Yeah, and I think a lot of
also a big thing. They shot a lot more threes last year. That was one of the features of the offense versus years past Tibbs' offenses. There was a concerted effort to shoot more three-pointers, and that's a byproduct of having a Mike Dunleavy and Aaron Brooks, the Nico Mirotic, you know, those other guys, those kind of not the focal point of the offense, but those dudes are there to shoot threes. That is their main job on offense. And Nico obviously didn't do it as well as the other two. Brooks and Dunleavy, before Rose got hurt, Brooks and Dunleavy were both top 10 in three-point field goal percentage. I'm nearly positive
Absolutely.
On that. They're both two of the best three-point shooters in the league. And then as soon as Rose went down, Brooks was thrust into a position that, you know, he's just not a starter. He's just not a starter in this league. I mean, at best, he's a high-energy guy that can give you 10, 12, 14-point spurts on a given night. That's what Brooks is at this point. But, you know, that's just the point I wanted to make was that there was much more emphasis on three-pointers in total across the board in offense last year in terms of offense. So that kind of had to do with the efficiency skyrocketing.
I think that also had to do with Gasol, though, a little bit, in my opinion, and the fact that he's such an excellent passer out of the post.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's like a symbiotic relationship, right? If you have three-point shooters and you have a good post player, your post game's going to get better and your three-point game's going to get better because the defense can't take away both. You know, they can take away one and then pass out of the other. You know, so, yeah, it's good. It's good stuff. Without a doubt, the guy made the offense infinitely better. And I just think overall, big picture, we're just so focused on defense in Chicago. You know, defense wins championships, all that other
stuff.
Yeah. You know, we don't realize what we got. Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things with Powell especially that I lost sight of during the season, was he's just pleasurable to watch on offense. You know, like you said, with the defense-first mentality in Chicago, like, you know, we used this black and blue type stuff, but it's like, it was a joy to watch Powell on offense, you know, like just to be able to score, like a competent NBA team, you know, like that's watching that team last year was probably, in terms of just entertainment, that was as close to Tibbs' first season as any. And the Rose injury season, that one, it just ended sourly, but Rose was in and out of the lineup that year anyway, so it wasn't like, and it was a short season, it was that lockout season, so it was kind of weird how fast the games were going, and I thought last season was enjoyable to watch for the most part. There were people, myself included, that got way too hung up on Powell's defense, so it's like, you know, you just got to step back for a second and be like, this is nice, this is pleasant to watch.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. So to see a guy that skilled at passing a ball, shooting the ball, it's so rare, you know, for a Chicago team to see a big man who could do the things he could. And, you know, I just don't get it. You know, I know I do understand that he's not, you know, Noah defensively, but to me our problems defensively last year just had a lot more to do with Noah. I understand, you know, he was asked to do a different role, be away from the basket more, but isn't that what made Noah great? You know, the fact that he could switch on to a guard.
Yeah, that was exactly
versatility.
It.
And then all of a sudden now the narrative has changed that we're asking Noah to do things he's not. No, not really. I mean, that's what he asked Noah to do then, is he was guarding everybody on the floor and, you know, all over the place. So, you know, he's a little bit more away from the basket, but.
The more appropriate thing to say would probably be that, you know, Tibbs kind of ran him into the ground with the minutes. I think that would be the more appropriate thing to look at in terms of why Joe's season played out the way it did. It was just painfully obvious that the guy was playing on one leg for a majority of that season, you know, and he just had, he gave everything he had. It was never a lack of effort. It was never a lack of care. It was never a lack of fire or intensity or any of those things. It's hard to play basketball when one of your knees operates at full functioning capacity and the other just does not. So that's, you know, when you want to look at Joe's season and people would point to the fact that he's playing out of position, you would then, in my opinion, you would have to look at Tibbs and say, well, why are you asking this dude who's playing on one leg to chase guys around the three-point line? You're not protecting your guy. You know, it's difficult for him. He's not going to say no. Joakim Noah is not going to turn down a challenge. Or, you know, if Tibbs approach him and says, okay, we're going to need you to be playing more around the perimeter, guarding some stretch fours next season. You know, I'm sure that conversation was had once they brought Powell in. Like, it was explained to Joe that he was going to be less around the basket than he was in previous seasons. But it's like, it didn't benefit him. He couldn't do it physically.
Yeah, don't ask your guys to do more than they're capable of. And last year he just wasn't able to do it. You know, and I felt sometimes they should play zone. to do something like that. But you see Popovich do it, you know. But now we're running when I run. This will always work. Yeah, whatever, dude. Yeah, I'm just glad we'll see some flexibility there. Now, I think Noah, too, to me, like the staple thing about Noah for so many years has been the put-back offensive rebound, where he gets the rebound and he puts it back and he screams running down the court. You hardly saw that at all last year. It just was gone.
No.
And it was because he didn't have that hop. He just didn't have it. That's my hope is, that, you know, rest another season away from that injury, that he comes back and we get his minutes down, and we get Gasol's minutes down. Gasol's minutes last year were insane for a guy his age playing the center position. He's top 20 in the league for a lot of the year. I mean, you know, it's nuts, you know. But I think you agree with me there. All right, so last part I did want to talk about was your solution, which I do disagree with. And your solution is to bring Gasol off the bench. So why don't you expound on that a little bit?
Well, that I kind of tried to leave open-ended, and I realized that I worded it a little poorly. I have no preference as to whether Powell is coming off the bench or Noah is coming off the bench. The only thing I know is those two need to be separated. And it doesn't really matter to me where my preference is in terms of, I think Powell brings X number of things better than Joe, or Joe brings X number of things more than Powell. I think they're, as long as one of them is playing center and one of them is the sixth man, I can live with that. I do believe that Powell would just absolutely feast on second units, that at this point in his career, and he did produce last year, so I'm not saying that he couldn't still produce against first units. I'm saying that just against second units, there's no center that could match him one-on-one in the post. He just would be a complete mismatch up and down the floor. And just because we've seen it, countless number of examples across the league, just because a guy is relegated to sixth man doesn't mean he wouldn't be closing, you know, part of the closing unit, which, as we know in Chicago, it's not who starts, it's who closes. That was the conundrum with the Boozer situation. You know, Taj would close games, Boozer would start them, and the better player was closing them. Tibbs always came to realize that the best player should be closing the game, or he would eventually come to that realization that the best guys need to be out there. So, I shouldn't say all the time. It sometimes took him more time than, you know, you would have liked to see. But, yeah, I don't have a preference one way or the other who's coming off the bench. That unit, that tandem just needs to be broken up, though. That's the one. If Fred does that, then he's already winning in my book.
Yeah, I see a little bit what you're saying. I think the it was a little bit overstated how bad Gasol and Noah were together. Like, I think by the end of the year, they were actually pretty solid. I don't recall the Bulls getting blown out in too many first quarters. In fact, they had a lot of really good first quarters, if you look at it, with those two together, especially in the Milwaukee series in the last couple of weeks. But I do agree that my issue is that if you take Gasol out and have him come off the bench, then you have Noah shooting 2 out of every 10 shots outside the paint, and Taj last year shot 2 of every 10 shots out of the paint and didn't shoot it that great out of the paint. You got two guys in your front court who aren't going to draw anybody away from the basket. You know, I think that's so important in today's game that you have somebody in the front court who can spread the floor. So I really would like to see, you know, Nico at all times on Nico paired with one of those two on the court, and then Gasol paired with one of those two on the court. So you at least got a big man at the 4 or 5 who's going to draw some people away from the rim. Believe it or not, though. I had our numbers guy pull it up.
Who do you think's the best tandems? You know what I'm saying?
I think Gasol and Taj were the best tandem last year. I think those guys were the best together when they were healthy.
I would agree.
And I thought they played really well together for the most part. I think Noah could be an excellent guy coming off the bench. Let's pull him, take out Gasol, take out Rose, and have Noah kind of go back to that role of a unique point center, and surround him with shooters. You know, I think that'd be kind of a cool role for him to get into next year. And I think he'll do it if you have a guy talk to him the correct way. You know, Tibbs can't talk to anybody. So you know, for hopefully Fred will be able to do that. But look what Steve Kerr did, you know, last year. You know, for him, how he went and spoke with each player and said, here's the role you're going to have, and, you know, convincing some guys who were lifelong starters to come off the bench. It's going to take a communicator like that. I'm hoping Fred can do it. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah.
I thought that I agreed with you as far as who the best tandems were. So, I mean, if anybody's coming off the bench, I would think that it should be Noah. I mean, Noah, in little spurts, I think showed some efficiency. I mean, I don't know exactly what to expect from him. I mean, we had somebody on the show a couple shows ago telling us that his knees are gone, he'll be out of the league in a year. I've heard other things that are saying that he's going to be healthy and he's going to be ready to go. Depends what we're getting out of Noah. I mean, if Noah's the Noah of 2 years ago, he should be starting. But if he's the Noah of last year, then there's no question in my mind that he should be coming off the bench, because he could be a defensive catalyst off the bench. He's going to be more effective, too. He's going to be more effective if he's going against the other team's bench. I think that Pau Gasol was too valuable last year to be coming off the bench. You know, I mean, as far as Nico goes, I mean, Pau can play some center. So could you do, like, Pau and Nico or something like that? I mean, I would think that one of the defensive players, whether it's Taj or Noah, should be starting one of those two guys, and that, you know, Pau or Nico. I mean, I don't, you know, Nico certainly hasn't earned his stripes yet. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see, I guess, how he comes back next year. I mean, you know, people are down on Nico. People are down on, you know, McDermott and stuff. But it's like, I don't put a lot of stock into a rookie season. It's like, to me, Nico had a tremendous rookie season. It was an incredible rookie season. It's just, you know, we'll see where he goes from here. But until I see it, until I see some more production from him, and especially because of Pau's Pau. And, I mean, guy's a veteran. He's been playing forever. He's one of the better players in the history of the NBA. I mean, I certainly couldn't see a situation where he shouldn't be starting, but the problem is I just don't see where we don't really have backup centers. It's kind of Noah and then everybody else who can maybe flip-flop in between. So, you know, Noah shouldn't be starting, in my opinion.
Yeah. So many people are going small, the league's moving away from that. What about you, Chris? What do you think?
The best tandem to me? was Joe and Nico, in my opinion, last year. I think that those two complement each other perfectly. I would be fine with those two being the bench unit, though. I could live with that because you're getting the perfect blend of offense and defense, and Nico hasn't proven himself to be an efficient scorer by any means, and that's kind of like a loose term. Like, you just want a guy to score. It doesn't matter how efficient he is at the end of the day. You know, just put the ball in the basket. But, you know, a lot's going to depend on where Nico's three-point shooting is next season, what his rebounding is like. Fred, I know that you've been a proponent of throwing the ball in the post to him more, which I agree with as well. I think that skill set was vastly underutilized last year. I think that he's finesse, but he's very meticulous. His footwork is good. He's very poised. He doesn't rush when he's in the post. He kind of tries to bait the refs into calling fouls too much, and we all can agree that he got a little bit excessive with the flopping and kind of just, you know, flailing, and he didn't get those calls in the postseason, which I know you, Fred, had said before the playoffs that that's gonna stop. Nico's not going to get calls, not going to get whistles in the playoffs, and he didn't. So I think as he learns the game, the way the customs are in the NBA, that's just a part of it. And like you said, Mark, just it's a rookie season. How much can you put into it? I think by all accounts, Nico had a great year. And I just love the way he looked with Joe. I think Joe really, with his passing, those two just gelled. And they just had a natural chemistry that was it just existed between them. The way their games they complement each other so well. I do like Taj and Powell together as well, just because that's a good offense defense balance there as well. You're getting Taj, who is as versatile a defender as there is in the league still. He can guard the five or the four, and he's super reliable in pick and roll, and he's a good rebounder, and he can defend shots at the rim. So to me, I think that Nico and Joe were the best, but I would definitely be okay with Powell and Taj starting as well.
What do you think about Nico's position going forward? I think this is an interesting topic. You know, I hear so much variance on there. Is he a natural four? Can he play minutes as a three? What's your take on him with his natural position?
I did not like him playing on the wing last year. I did not like him much at all. And it's funny because that was kind of Tibbs' version of being flexible, was finding Nico minutes at the three spot. I guess it would be too early to write it off. We don't have a huge sample size in terms of what the jumbo lineups, the Noah, or Powell, Taj, Nico, you know, with three of those four guys in at the same time. We can't dismiss it entirely. I anticipate seeing a lot less of it, just kind of knowing what we know already from Hoiberg, and that would be A-okay by me. I think that Nico is a big man who can play on the wing, but he's not a wing player. So that's valuable in the sense that, yeah, he can play around the wing, and he does have kind of guard skills and some unique ball handling ability for a guy that's 6'11". And I think he's a gifted passer as well. In those instances where Nico was forced into playing three, he actually ran the pick and roll as a ball handler pretty damn well for a guy at 6'11". I mean, you can kind of slip those pocket passes in there. It's just like a natural gifted touch that you can't teach guys with that size to have.
Right.
At the end of the day, my point would be that he's a wing player. He's a post player that can play the wing, but still a post player. You shouldn't try and turn him into a wing player exclusively.
I know. I know that's pretty much consensus too. I just disagree a little bit in that. You know, Mark, I know we were at that Memphis game and seeing Nico basically playing the three, I think, a lot in that game. The guy just has the ability to get to the rim, too, that you just don't see from power forward. He really looked like a three to me in that game. Like, this guy can play the three. Not defensively, but
defensively, he's too slow.
He had problems at both positions. He was too light to play the four really well. I swear to God, if that guy got on a scale, I bet you he was 212 last year at the end of the season. He was so skinny. It's going to be interesting to see how he looks, you know, how much muscle he puts on and what, you know, he could go several ways. Like, he could just bulk up and say, all right, I'm going to be a four, and that's my position. Or he could still stay the way he is, and I think you could find minutes with him at the three. I really do. Like, I'm not worried about Luol Deng destroying Nico Mirotic. I'm not.
But where are you going to get you have a lot of great threes in the league right now. Where are you going to get the lateral quickness to be able to defend them? Because it matters. I mean, the defense matters, especially for that specific position. it's a very different position when you're playing the four and the three defensively.
Kind of torn on it, because I also feel that, like, I want to see Nico so badly a lot more in the post, and that's where he's going to take those guys, right? You throw a three on Nico, take him immediately in the post. You throw a four on him, you take him in the three-point line. He just didn't it's the season. I get a general vibe that guys think he had a better year than he really did. He had, like, a fantastic stretch in March where he got to the line, like, 5 to 12 times a game. He was scoring a lot of points during that period, but he wasn't shooting it well. He didn't shoot it well all year, really. Look at the stats. I mean, the guy shot 30% from three and 40% from the field. That's not good, you know? And,
yeah.
And in the playoffs, he was just terrible. I mean, I didn't expect him to do well. I didn't expect him to do that. I mean, he sucked. Mm-hmm. He sucked. And especially in the – and he's so important, and he's just oozing with talent. I think it's better for him. I felt like, and I know you agree, Chris, that I did think when they occasionally went to him in the post, good things happened. And they didn't do it nearly enough. And he's got that game. Why not utilize that? Why not go to that? And his shooting percentage will go up. He'll get more confident. He shot like over 60%, I believe, in a restricted area. And he shot worse than Noah outside the paint. So, I mean,
yeah,
it's got to be something to look at, according to our new analytics guy. He told me that. I couldn't believe it, but apparently it's true.
It's confusing.
It's
confusing how he shot so poorly, but yet the team numbers, they're always consistently better on offense with Nico in the game versus him off the game. You know, that's what never made it much sense about it. It's like, okay, so he's bringing something, and it was kind of hard to parse out, like, and define what Nico brought when he was in the games. I mean, yeah, he's versatile, but you can't really quantify that. Yet all the numbers would suggest that the team is clearly better with him in the game. It's just like, it was confusing constantly. It's like, okay, well, he's shooting 30% from the three-point line, so he's not really aiding them there. He gets the free throw line a lot. Yeah, that's good. But then, like you said, in the playoffs, he wet the bed, so it's like, if he's not doing that, you can't have him out there because, as Mark was saying, he's a liability defensively. Whether he's at three or the four, he's just not good. He's just not there yet defensively. And we all kind of expected that. So, you know, I'm not going to criticize him there. He should get better, for sure.
I don't want to make any gross rationalizations about what he can and cannot be. I mean, he was a rookie. Mm-hmm. He was the top two candidate for Rookie of the Year. When you look at his March, look, that was a lot of games. And, I mean, in all those games in March when the pressure was really on him because, you know, Butler and Rose were both out, he shot 44%. 3-point percent.
Mark,
that sucks.
I don't think there's anybody here. I hope you guys don't. I hope you guys agree with me. I feel this guy could be an all-star. Not only an all-star once, but multiple times. There's nothing the guy can't do on the offensive end.
And he was not a good team. How many great rookies do you normally see on a team as competitive as the Bulls? That changes everything. Because it's not like Wiggins, who's got, you know, every opportunity to fail, especially under a guy like Thibodeau. It's like, I mean, if Mirotić makes a mistake, he was taken out of the game, especially early in the year. And it was just like, Nico had to find his footing, and he didn't really get that opportunity to find it. It was like when he had
the
great.
He only
stretch,
got the opportunity because of injuries. That's the other thing, too, people forget.
Exactly.
If Noah wasn't hurt.
Back in the playoffs, once the playoffs started, he did not play single digits in a single game in all of March and all of April. And then the minute that the playoffs starts, he has 13 minutes, 8 minutes, 7, 2 minutes against Cleveland. I mean, his minutes are all over the place. He played
That's
in the Cleveland
point.
Series. The first game, he had two minutes. Second game, 7 minutes. Third game, 22 minutes. I mean, 18, 18, then 13. Players have.
And that was his one good game. Yeah, that was his
and
one good game.
And when you look at the minutes
of
players on any other team, there is consistency. You don't see guys flying all over the place. I expect this to be a very different team this year, assuming that Hoiberg is a normal coach and he's not batshit crazy like Tom Thibodeau. Like, he was unconventional. He did things other guys simply do not do. And especially, the minutes, it's just no coach does that. And I just cannot imagine the Hoiberg's going to be flying guys around all these minutes where they don't know what to expect. How do you expect them to find consistency? We have never had a rookie, especially at least in the Thibodeau era, we've never had a rookie that really had the promise of Nico either. So it's like, you know, to be jerking around a guy like Tony Snell is different than be jerking around a guy like Nico, who proved that he could be a 20-point a game scorer. I don't feel.
I
like
know people. Yeah, I know people are going to say he's the X factor, man, and that's Cleveland series. He hurt the Bulls. He made us worse when he was out there, and there's no way that's going to happen again. So how much better is he going to be against Cleveland next year? I know they're going to have Love, But how much better is he going to be, and how much better are the Cleveland going to be with Love? He's the X factor. And McDermott's the last one. I know nobody believes this, but I really believe that Doug McDermott is going to be a really good NBA basketball player. I'm laughing as I say it because I know so many people are rolling their eyes as they're listening to this, but he will be. I just
think it's one season. It's just, how do you get so down? Not you, but how do people get so down on somebody a rookie year where he had a knee injury and he was gone for half the damn year? I just don't get where people get so crazy about it.
Chris, what do you think about McDermott?
Well, I wish I could borrow some of your optimism in the case of McDermott. I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical. And I don't look so much at any of the raw numbers or the percentages of what he shot. And he's a better 3-point shooter than what he shot last year. There's no question. You know, he's not going to shoot whatever he shot. Was it like, you know, 28% or something? Like, he shot ridiculously low. He didn't have a lot of attempts either. But it's like, he's not that bad. We all know that he's not that bad of a shooter. His shooting form, his stroke is too pure. It's just, it's picture perfect. It's exactly how you design a basketball shot. I mean, it's just, it's a beautiful shot. So he will shoot better. I don't have much doubt there. I wonder where he can contribute beyond scoring. That's kind of my biggest concern and why I'm so skeptical, because I don't think he can play the four much at all. I don't view him as a stretch four. So if we kind of peg him as being a three, or at least if I'm going to peg him as being a three, I don't see him adding much value on the perimeter defensively. I don't see him being a great rebounder, being away from the basket. He's not a guy that's got quick hands, and he doesn't anticipate passing lanes or anything like that. He just kind of tries to not screw up. That was his problem mostly last year on defense. He played, and you can probably blame a little bit on Tibbs, that he played nervous, you know, like he just didn't want to screw up. And then when he would, he knew that, all right, I'm about to get yanked. So that's tough to play under, there's no doubt. But you can't play defense thinking with the mind frame that, oh, I can't screw up, I can't screw up, I can't, you know, you just can't play defense that way. You can't play basketball that way. You just have to, the game based on rhythm and flow, you know, you have to just kind of play mindless in a sense.
I can't imagine why I'd be nervous. I mean, having some madman screaming at him and first mistake getting pulled. I mean, you should play nice and cool and calm in that type of atmosphere. No, I agree with you. I mean, it's like, my thing with McDermott is, I think number one, he's got a better, another guy you could throw in a post that I just shake my head that, you know, I don't even think it was considered by Tibbs, but, you know, watching the summer league this year, I'm praying that they go to him in the post when he gets the right matchup. And, you know, just those guys that can shoot, they're just so freaking valuable. And that's one thing that you just don't lose. Like, it's, you know, when you're done shooting and you sit for an entire quarter, and then you sit for the middle of the second quarter, and then you ask to come in and then, you know, start hitting immediately or else you're getting out, that's difficult to do. I don't think Fred will put him in that situation.
He only played 36 games last year. It's just, I understand where people have skepticism over what they think what they think that he can and cannot be, but it's like, look, he only played 36 games. So the next part of it is that by the time that he came back, he'd missed like 3 months. So it's just like, and Thibodeau, the minutes situation, everything. We've seen enough of Doug McDermott to know that the guy can play basketball. And I'm just like, I don't like to put a ton of – look, if we want to put stock into it, let's look at Kobe Bryant's rookie season. If Lakers fans after Kobe Bryant's rookie season – but I'm saying, if Lakers fans after Kobe Bryant's rookie season were like, we're jumping –
I'm looking at Kyle Korver.
I'm not saying that I want to compare him to Kobe Bryant. I'm just saying a lot of players have had poor first years or have had something that occurs the first year that have kind of gotten them off the path. I'm not going to judge somebody, especially somebody that was so low down on the totem pole as McDermott. McDermott wasn't going to get a lot of minutes anyway. And the minute that he got injured, that kind of just rode his ticket for the rest of the year, especially under a coach like Tom Thibodeau. Most coaches wouldn't be that way. Tom Thibodeau's is the Antichrist, so it was that way.
Oh, come on. Let's wrap this baby up with Chris's prediction for wins next year. Mark, you give yours, I'll give mine, and then we'll say adios. I gotta run, hit the ground running here. Go ahead. Chris, what's your
So wins, I'll probably peg him at 54, just under 55. What did they have last year? 50 exactly, right?
50, yep.
Yeah, they
even with
exactly
Heinrich's 50. Foul against Dallas.
Oh,
remember
yeah
that one?
Yeah, he threw that game. Yeah, he just, that was
what a winner.
The most idiotic
what
foul
winner
I've ever seen. Yeah, oh, man, thank goodness all that grit was out there. Yeah. I think we can reasonably expect a bump up in wins, assuming health, which realistically we should never assume health. I don't know why we do it. You know, there's going to be injuries next year. Hopefully just they're not significant. You know, that's really all you can just cross your fingers. Yeah, exactly. You know that there's going to be the dings and the bruises, and hopefully the team moves to more resting guys and giving guys off certain nights. And like Derek specifically, just don't play him on back-to-back. That would be a great solution to kind of prolonging his career and getting the most out of him, is just sit him on back-to-back. You don't need to play him in consecutive games. That's not how the playoff format works. You're not going to have to face that when the games matter, so why would you do it during the regular season? Make sure he's, you know, obviously still in game shape. Don't baby him, but just monitor him more closely. And not that they didn't do a good – he was on a minutes restriction last year, so they did a good job with that, or as best a job as they could, I suppose. But, yeah, 54 wins, I think, is a slight increase over what Tibbs had last year. And, you know, anything under 50 would probably be that wouldn't be good. I don't want to – imagine that reality yet.
Go ahead, Mark.
60 wins. Derrick Rose is going to average 23.5 points a game. He's going to shoot 44.5%. I think it's going to be a different team next year, especially the fact, look, people underestimate the fact that Derrick Rose was just coming back from not having played in 3 years. Look at how different Jordan was when he came back and he missed those two seasons, and then he came back his first year back was in 94-95, and he was not nearly as good as he was before, yet he hadn't been injured for 3 years. Now he was in baseball shape. Well, baseball shape's a lot better than having an ACL tear and sitting in the hospital. Derrick Rose had not played barely for three freaking seasons. After a full season and going at it this offseason, we're going to see a different Derrick Rose next year. I'm 100% convinced. Now that he got that meniscus taken care of, look, everyone's going to get on him too. He got injured again next year. He's got the meniscus tear. It's like, look, the meniscus tear was because he decided to repair his meniscus, which was already a risky procedure that had a very low percentage of being successful. He took that chance to prolong his career. It failed. Well, Dwayne Wade got that procedure done when he was in high school. And Dwayne Wade's been playing his entire NBA without a meniscus. Derrick Rose is going to fall apart by the time that he's 45, but the fact is that he's going to have still a very successful NBA career. This is his comeback year. If he doesn't do it this year, I'm jumping off the bandwagon. But I'm going to tell you what, right now I'm going to go out and buy my D-Rose 6s. Call it.
Yeah, I mean, to me there's nothing more overrated than trying to win as many games as possible in the regular season. Besides, you have to know what Thibodeau – to the point, you know, he won 48 games in Noah's almost MVP year, and he walks into the playoffs looking like the Tin Man, you know, on one leg. So I know one thing, Fred will sacrifice wins for growth of the younger players and sacrifice wins for the health of the older ones. And that's all that matters to me. You know, how good are we going to be going into playoffs? You can't ever guarantee that somebody's not going to tear an ACL or have a, you know, catastrophic injury. That's something you can't prevent. But you can make sure that every guy who comes in the playoffs is somewhat healthy. Cleveland sat LeBron for 2 full weeks last year, basically went on sabbatical midseason. Do that with Derek if you have to. Get these guys strong. And you know what? If we win 48, 49, who cares? Who cares? We might have two less wins than we would have with Thibodeau, but we'll be a better team come playoff time because our younger players will have played more. They'll be ready for the playoffs, and they'll be, you know, on – we'll have a team that's ready to play as a team, as opposed to just a few guys who are kind of, you know, maxed out for the most part.
We're in the East. We ain't winning 48, 49 games, man. If we win 48, 49 games, we ain't beating the Milwaukee Bucks.
Oh, come on. That's not true.
We ain't winning 48, 49 games.
Let me tell you right now, Orlando's going to be a lot better. There's going to be less wins going around.
Why? Why is Orlando going to be a lot better?
Because they got Scott Skiles, and that's always happens when Scott Skiles coaches the team. And they have a ton of talent, and they have Elfrid Payton, and they have a lot of good young players, Oladipo. I like that team.
They're not competing for a playoff spot. There's nobody in the East this year besides maybe in Indiana that's competing for a playoff spot that wasn't last year. Unless I'm – hang on, let me give it a quick gander. I just want to make sure I'm serious here. Yes.
Milwaukee's better.
Fine, but that's a playoff. There's no non-playoff team that's going to be much better.
Indiana's better.
Wait, Cleveland's the same. Indiana's better. What else?
Milwaukee, don't sleep on Toronto.
A little better. Oh, come on. Toronto's
Miami?
The same. Orlando's not making the playoffs. Dude, Hakeem Olajuwon schooled Nikola Vucevic last week in the African game. Come on. This guy's 53 years old.
Knicks will be – let me try to think here. Boston's got to be better than you think,
so
right? I mean, it can't be any worse.
I win 15 games this year. Congratulations.
It's a miracle that team got in the playoffs. Every time I look at that roster, I just want to go hug. I mean, it's unbelievable. How did that even get in the playoffs?
They're better this year. I think that he could be – Brad Stevens could be the best coach in the NBA. He might be. I mean, with the talent
he might
that
be.
He
I want to hug him every time I see that roster. That roster's horrible.
Evan Turner's like the best player on the team. Didn't I send you a stat last week, Fred? Like, there wasn't a single starter other than one guy. There wasn't a single starter on that team that averaged more than 45%. I mean, it was ridiculous how bad of a shooting team
they
were.
Detroit better?
No,
Detroit
not
better?
Barely.
Didn't they get someone though? Didn't they get somebody semi-major? They got something.
They got one of the Morris twins. Detroit did, and then
yeah, there you go, Marquis. Yeah.
They got Marcus. No, they got Markieff wants out.
Oh, they got from Milwaukee. They got what's his name? Ilyasovich.
Ilyasovich.
Yeah,
they're not
yep.
better.
Really, if you run through the teams, Nets are worse. Atlanta's, well.
You can start. You could literally start Snell every single game this season, not play Derrick Rose at all until the playoffs, and we will make the playoffs with a landslide. The East sucks. It's sad.
I think Chris is more in my set. It sounds like I think the East is better this year. Starting with
Orlando. I think it's improved. Yeah. I mean I thought that last year as well, and then that didn't go so hot. But I don't know. I mean Miami's a team to look out for if they're healthy, obviously. That's a big caveat with all these teams. You know, you have to just pray that
they
stay healthy, or you know, as for the Bulls, pray that they're healthy. For other teams, you know, depending on your rooting interest. But you know, I think Miami will be there. I'm telling you, Toronto, I like what they did this offseason. I'm not very sold on what Washington did. They were kind of limited as well, but they don't really scare me as much. I mean, they got Wall and Beal. Wall's great. I love Wall, but
lost Pierce.
I like Beal too. I like
Beal.
Yeah, but you're right. But and their big front court's getting older. Man, how much longer is Nene going to do this? Right? I saw some signs of age last year.
Exactly.
What did Toronto really do though? Why is Toronto going to be much better?
They couldn't defend anybody. They couldn't defend a soul last season. So they got Damari Carroll from Atlanta.
Yep.
I like the Corey Joseph pickup. That was a guy who I was hoping the Bulls could nab away from the Spurs while they were kind of trying to do that balancing act of signing with Marcus Aldridge and figuring out the rest of their free agent situation. But, you know, Toronto
Corey
paid
Joseph,
a handsome dollar for Corey Joseph. So I like that signing for him. They got Bismack Biyombo from the Hornets, who's just a defensive beast. He doesn't do anything offensively. He's horrible offensively, but I mean that team needed defense desperately, and I like the idea that they're kind of going to try and play that small ball, play fast type identity. I think that fits them because they're not going to have a problem scoring. So they could be another regular season success and then playing out in the postseason. That's what they've been the past two seasons. They've just been pretenders come to postseason. But I like the fact that they made the effort to get better on defense and they address a lot of needs they had. So that's kind of why I'm high on them.
Does anybody really think so this season, especially with the fact that Atlanta's taken a step back? Does anybody really think that at the end of the day, anybody besides Chicago and Cleveland are going to be the two competing for the Eastern Conference crown?
Seems like it. That's
can I just say one thing about the Sixers? I actually, believe it or not, went to a late season Denver Nuggets Sixers game. And, you know, probably midway through the third quarter it hit me. I kind of actually saw potential. Like, holy cow, this team defensively could be freaking awesome in a certain X amount.
They weren't bad. They weren't bad on defense last year. They were, like, middle of the pack.
Which is – look how young that team is. So
right.
If you expect some kind of growth from those guys, I mean, it was amazing how good they were defensively. Now, again, they're playing Denver. So, you know,
right.
That's the caveat right there. But they beat Denver in Denver.
I'm looking back saying
– I was just thinking, is this team – I think it's got potential. Remember, we had a hard time with them in one game, too. You know, and I'm not saying they're going to make it in the playoffs, but they could be a load to handle in a couple of years if you know, they get, you know.
Well, they're putting all the pieces – they're putting all the structure in place. They're laying down the infrastructure. I love what Brent Brown, their coach, I love the way that he has them playing. It's like they're a bunch of second-round picks, D-League, overseas players, but it's like they're running – legit stuff. You know, they're not just rolling the ball out there and saying, okay, let's try and get this game over as quick as we can. You know, they're not just trying to go out there and waste time. They're doing everything with a purpose. And it's like, it's hard to bring yourself to watch a 76ers game like that. I get it, you know, because it's like you don't even know some of the dudes' names that are out there. And it's like they pick up guys randomly left and right. And it's like it's a whole process in itself. But they do, they make an effort to run certain things. Like they're doing stuff that just they don't have the talent. It's obvious. I mean, it's an obvious team, but they just don't have any talent.
I think they definitely have the defensive talent.
Especially losing Embiid.
Yeah.
They won't be any better.
They have the defensive talent, though. I mean, Noel, and they definitely have defensive talent. That Covington is pretty long. Like, I mean, that's where I see them building, and I can see them potentially being just, you know, like Thibodeau. If you really, that would be a dream team for that guy to coach, believe it or not.
God.
If they can get just one guy who can score, you know, and just he doesn't care about that, and just throw it to whoever the guy is can score. But they have some defensive pieces that could be awesome in a few years, so. But
yeah.
I that should happen, right? If you have like 16 in a row, number one overall picks or top.
You got to hit on one, right?
Exactly. Guys, I got to hit the road running.
Tell that to Michael Jordan.
Hey, come on, man. They made the playoffs.
I was looking the other day at the last like 15 Charlotte picks, and it's just like, oh my God, like.
They got Frank, man. That's good for 10 more wins.
Frank the Tank. There you go.
Yeah,
well,
he thought he did Arizona, right,
Mark? Let's take out Frank because Frank hasn't played a single game in the NBA yet, and we'll see when he fails like Adam Morrison did. But look at the rest. Yeah,
oh,
I couldn't even name you half the guys. He's done a terrible job with the crowd. They should be better. I'm just saying.
All right. Well.
Go both.
I like Frank. I believe in Frank. I think he's going to be good. But you know,
well, you like guys that shoot threes and don't do anything else.
I love the shooters. I got to admit.
I mean, that's your thing.
Oh my God. I do.
You have a three-point fetish, Fred. You have a three-point fetish.
Three is greater than two, Mark. Never forget it. All right, guys. I got to hit the road.
All right.
Can't thank you enough for jumping on, man. Enjoyable to have you on. We got to have you on again throughout the season. Very good stuff.
I would love to. Guys.
Keep on writing those controversial articles. Keep on coming around to our line of thought. I can't wait for the next St. Paul episode where you come in and talk about how much you love Doug McDermott. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, we'll see about that, man.
Thanks again, Chris. And until next time, Fred, if it ain't Bulls.
It ain't basketball. We'll be right back.